All right. So welcome to the Scramble. We're going to do something different at the end of the show today. Let me just set up the whole show and then I'll explain that. So for the first two segments, if there's a through line here, and of course we designed this, of course we planned this all out, it's about women who kind of transform themselves or go off in directions that you might not have expected. So we'll start out by talking to Anna Gasteyer. You remember her from Saturday Night Live. Today, more of her career probably is focused on singing. She's a very, very good singer. We'll go from there to Rochelle Ripley, somebody who I knew, let's say, 38 years ago. I did not know at that time she was one quarter Lakota Sioux. I would not have guessed, based on who she was back in those days, that she would become a real activist for the Lakota Sioux and for addressing their poverty and their lack of health care. She's now been named to a list of the top 10 heroes of the year by CNN. And there's a whole kind of voting thing where if she wins, she gets another $100,000 to do things for the Lakota Sioux. So anyway, all of that's coming along here. And then at the end, we're going to do something we haven't done, really. Rather than book a guest for the final segment, I like a lot of people, am perplexed and struggling with my own reactions to some of the things happening on college campuses right now, and both at Yale and Missouri most prominently. There have been sort of there have been confrontations between students and administrators with peculiar outcomes and maybe about peculiar subjects. Anyway, I'm going to share some of my own rambling, incoherent thoughts. Won't that be fun about that? And also invite you to call in. That's at the end of the show, though, so I won't give out the number right now. As I say, as promised, we are going to begin the show with Anna Gasteyer. And as I said before, you know her from Saturday Night Live. But now, please do know her as a singer. She will be performing at the Katharine Hepburn Cultural Arts Center, better known as the Kate, in Old Saybrook, on November 24th at 7:30. That will become part of our sister station CPTV's new national music series, The Kate. And people who go to see Anna at this thing will be part of a live taping and may become incredibly famous themselves. I think that's happened a few times. Lana Turner went to the first one, and her movie career took off right afterwards. So first of all, Anna, welcome to the show.
Hey. Thanks so much.
So we're going to talk about singing and music, and then we're going to talk about comedy. Those are two of my favorite topics.
That's pretty much all I do, so that's good.
That's right, yeah. I was also going to bring up a traditional Chinese medicine as well, but it turns out you're not that well briefed on that.
I'm not. So I don't know that much. Every now and again, I get a cold, and I buy something in a panic.
All right. So we'll skip that one. So I'm going to begin just maybe by playing something from your new CD. We're going to play the title track. It's a tune by David Frisberg. It's called I'm Hip. Why don't we play a little bit of that, and then we can talk about it.
I rock a jumpsuit and a lengthy bang, 'cause I'm hip. I dig. I'm in step. When it was hip to be hip, I was hip. Habs blue ribbon in a can. Strumming gaily my ukulele. Follow me on Instagram, 'cause I'm hip. If I prattle too fast on my edgy podcast, then it's my bad. Every Saturday night, using Tumblr and Skype on my iPad. I'm too much.
All right, so Anna, first of all, I would sing along with that. I've actually sung that song to an audience myself, except I can't because you've changed the lyrics all over the place. So the song was written by David Frisberg, I believe, made kind of famous by Blossom Dearie, if anybody...
Yeah, and he wrote it with Bob Dereaux, too.
With
they
Bob
wrote
Dereaux.
It together.
That's right.
Blossom Dearie did make it kind of famous, and then it's just one of those songs. I'm glad to hear you sung it, too, that it's... I don't ordinarily rewrite people's songs, but... because, of course, the lyrics are super genius off the first one, but it so adapts itself to hilarious and contemporary rewrites. You know, Bette Midler did a version. I mean, lots of people have done their own little version of it. And I do live in Brooklyn, and so as and I admire Blossom Dearie tremendously. That was the version that I knew really well. And so as I was thinking about different songs, when you're kind of putting together a musical act, like you would in traditional musical theater, you have your little I want song, sort of what's this evening going to be about. And with a certain amount of irony, it felt fun to call myself out for not being a hip hipster.
Well, yeah, so everybody messes with that song a little bit, and actually the thing that gets changed most often, I think the original version is Sammy Davis Knows My Friend, but there that turned into John Travolta Knows My Friend. I mean, there's sort of a different celebrity depending on what era you're singing it in. So, but so you've gone further and kind of used it to satirize the Brooklyn hipster scene, and I mean, because the song is, as you say, fundamentally self-effacing. The person who's singing it is arguing for his or her own hipness.
Exactly.
In so many cliches of, back in the old days, it's one more time, play Mac the Knife. It's, you know, so many sort of jazz cliches that pretty soon that person is revealed as anything but
hip. Yep.
And hopelessly unoriginal. So you've preserved that spirit of it, right?
I've tried to. Thanks for, I hope so. Yeah.
And so I want to talk a little bit. I'm most curious how singers do choose music. And so the album, which I assume kind of parallels the live act, is it's far from being a bunch of jazz standards or American songbooks, right? There are things from the American songbook like Cheek to Cheek, but you go from I'm Hip, which is sort of a jazz and cabaret classic for people who know that kind of thing, to One Mint Julep, which I think we'll hear at the end of this segment. That was a kind of early 1950s jump blues song, to the Book of Love by Mike Doughty, who's a friend of this show and an alt-rock guy who's very much of the moment, to Defying Gravity from Wicked, which you appeared in on Broadway. So how do you put these things together? How do you make the decisions that these are the songs?
Right, so those are probably the linchpin or tentpole songs. You know, they all have different logic to them. The overriding principle is, you know, one that I call entertainer's jazz or ridiculous jazz. A lot of the songs that are on the record, I would suppose I have to include I'm Hip at this point in it, are what people would call kind of novelty songs. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, as a comedian who sings, I think I was naturally drawn to this entertainer's era in the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s, that had this kind of swing to it and fun to it, but also allowed for a lot of comedy to come in musically. So I think just a lot of, you know, but it is all over the map. It's basically, you know, a cabaret act with jazzy theme to it, I guess you would call it. Defying Gravity I have on there simply because I know that fans of Wicked, who, you know, when you do Wicked, you do build up a nice little following of a specific kind of fan. And that's why we put it on, because it was basically to respect the people who were probably going to buy the record. But I also love the song, and I like the version of it, and I think it's an unusual version, and it's not loud, and it's not brassy, and it's not obnoxious. So it worked to play it almost as a ballad and to treat the song completely isolated from the musical, you know.
Well, and it also gets you out from under a shadow a little bit. You're a really terrific singer. I'm sure you get this all the time, but I thought of you as a comedian. I was surprised to hear what a good singer you are. However, nobody's Idina Menzel. I mean, she's the person who made that song famous. You're not going to do it as brassy and big as she did.
Yeah, and it wasn't interesting to me to do that, because it's not a musical theater record, and it's not none of the music, like you said, and the rest of the playlist has nothing to do with that, really. So it was kind of a last-minute decision, only because of the quality of the way that we recorded it, that it has kind of a more quiet moment. And I think even in the most loud and most ridiculous album, which obviously we're largely going for, a couple of nice quiet moments like The Book of Love and Defying Gravity give the listener a break. And, you know, my producer, Julian Fleischer, is a huge aficionado of the old-fashioned, you know, record experience. So laying down and listening to something start to finish. I know nobody actually listens to a record like that, but you still go about your business trying to create it that way.
People,
you know,
sometimes do. People sometimes stay with the whole playlist.
Yeah.
We're not totally an iPod shuffle generation.
Not yet. Well, and then probably anyone who's buying my record isn't going to be inclined to listen to it, you know, soup to nuts. But, you know, that's part of the listening experience, too. I mean, the songs that I really, One Mint Julep, and then there's a song, A Proper Cup of Coffee, the Cheek to Cheek version, they all tend to kind of fall into this category that's up-tempo, fun, outrage, you know, outrageousness.
Well, actually, since you mentioned Book of Love and I mentioned Book of Love, let's hear a little bit of it. This is by Mike Doughty, who's actually been in here in these studios performing, although I don't think he did this song on that day.
The Book of Love is long and boring. No one can lift the damn thing. It's full of charts and facts and figures and instructions for dancing. But I
That's Anna Gasteyer singing The Book of Love. Okay, this is kind of interesting because you described yourself earlier in the interview as a comedian who sings, although you could also be described maybe as a singer who detoured into comedy and back. And,
that's exactly right.
Yeah, maybe that's...
I fell down the rabbit hole.
That might be a little truer. So, and this is interesting because I think a common thread running through a lot of these songs, as you are suggesting, is they either are funny or can be made funny, or they have something a little bit funny about them. So Mike's song, and when you hear Mike sing it, Mike always sounds kind of dry and world weary. I mean, that's just kind of, I don't think he can sing a song without some of that creeping in. Here, you've really kind of gone for the sincerity of it. I mean, if you listen to the lyrics, the Book of Love is long and boring. No one can lift the damn thing. It's full
right.
of fact. So, and instructions for dancing. It's a sardonic lyric.
Yes,
but
definitely.
You've really gone, you've pushed the sincerity in your delivery.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a beautiful song in a very modern, with a modern sentiment, which is sort of self-reflexive and ironic. You know, I think that it's not. It's a beautiful piece of music melodically, and of course the sentiment is beautiful. But I guess when I look at a piece of material, I never ever as is strangely evident in everything I've ever done comedically, like, you know, the NPR girls or whatever on SNL, the thing that irritates me the most in the world is earnestness. So I could never attack music and to be accused of being overly earnest is my worst nightmare. So I just don't, I like to be able to kind of find what's fun about something. And even in my sincerity, I think I tend to do that, you know?
Right. And, you know, one of the differences, I think, between cabaret, which is kind of what you're doing here, and, say, jazz or singing with a big band or something, is you really do have to have lyrics, I think. You know, I mean, you know, Ella can get up there and sing a tisket,
totally.
A tisket, a tasket, and it doesn't really make any difference what she's singing. It just sounds great, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're singing that intimately and singing with an audience, you really have to have lyrics, and you have to connect to them, right?
Yeah, and that's what I am first as an entertainer. I like to connect with an audience. Doing live performances about that. Music is just another way to do it. And it's not that I have to be funny all of the time, but you're right. There's just an intelligent conversation that you're happening with an audience, and it feels, you know, I mean, I'm not actively choosing against it, I guess, but I just, the music I tend to naturally be drawn to has humor in it, you know, for lack of a better way of looking at it. I mean, when I'm putting material together and thinking about songs I want to work on arrangements for, I put these epic playlists together and I play them over and over around the house, and I basically just sort of study my family and my kids and myself and see like how, what it is that we keep going back to and what makes us happy when we're making dinner and when we're drinking. Well, the children don't drink, luckily, but when you know, I'm having friends over with drinks, like what feels fun and feels ridiculous and puts you in a good mood, and that tends to be music that I'm drawn to.
All right, and to that end, we're gonna end, when we get to the end of the segment, we're gonna end with Anna singing One Mint Julep, which
yep.
takes all the mystery about whether drinking is going on or not. And so, but let's sort of make the little transition here. So, I mean, on Saturday Night Live, you did occasionally perform musically, but for laughs, right? You were, you were this part of this incredibly dorky, a couple of middle school teachers teaching music. I don't even know how to describe them exactly, but
that's about right.
Yeah.
I did a lot of musical characters. I did a folk singer that actually in real life we performed at Lilith Fair. She was sort of like a earnest folk singer who did comic songs. I named Cinder Calhoun, and I did a parody of Destiny's Child with Maya Rudolph. So I ended up doing, you know, again, what happens in comedy and sketch comedy in particular is you tend to just pull from whatever toolbox you have, and it was a resource I had and that I could use. But I sang my way into college. I got into Northwestern as a singer, and then after a year of classical training and hanging out with classical music majors, I found the comedy people and kind of, like I said, fell down that rabbit hole, and then didn't really revisit. I kind of gave up. I was like, I'm not going to really be a singer, and, you know, just hung out with comedy people and did the comedy thing and got a degree in theater and graduated and went out to L.A. and joined the Groundlings, where I did sing, again, as needed, like as a part of an improv or something, but I never considered myself. I felt like I dropped the ball in terms of training, so I thought it was like a lost cause. But then when I was here in New York, you know, like I said, it's kind of my first passion, and so I would go to shows all the time. I would see, you know, Joe's Pub. I'd see the sort of modern nightclub shows. I would see shows on Broadway. And I started being asked, you know, people would hear me sing on the show, and they could actually hear that I could sing, people interested in funny musicians. And so I got pulled in for auditions for Broadway shows. And then I really started to get serious about it. And when I left the show, when I left SNL, really put my mind to kind of catching up, for making up for lost time. And so I started training in earnest, and basically that's all I did was musicals for about 5 years. So, as soon as that happened, I had an act of sorts and took that out, and, you know, the rest is kind of where we are now.
Well, you know, you and Maya Rudolph are both great examples of people who were comic with their singing voices. And I assume that that gives you a little bit of a shield, right? When you're singing to get laughs,
oh, yeah.
you don't have to worry so much about how...
Your vocal quality, no.
So was it terrifying to sing for real instead?
Yes, it was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Because once you're in the ring with... I mean, Broadway singers are... No joke. Yeah. They're really good, and they know their instruments really well, and they're, you know, it's all, I mean, forgive me, but the 10,000 hours thing is 100% true in my experience. Just the more time I spent, the more I trained, and then frankly playing a role like Elphaba for as long as I played it, you know, which was over a year between Chicago and Broadway, and, you know, just constantly examining your own, getting to know your instrument under duress, basically, mm-hmm. because you're exhausted and because there's smoke and fog and because you're sick and because things happen in a year, you know, you just start to really know, you start to know your own voice. And I also just think the muscles change dramatically by singing eight shows a week in 7 days, you know.
Oh, I would think. Yeah, no, I would think you get over a lot of things because you've got to do them.
Yeah, totally. There's sort of no substitute for those Broadway show. And then I had a weird thing because I did Elphaba, which is very blasty and belty, as you referenced, and then I did left Chicago and I did the Three Penny Opera here on Broadway, which was completely the opposite, very legit. And then I did Elphaba again, so it was kind of great vocally. I had a lot of opportunity, and then I did a Sondheim show called Passion after that, which was also very legit and also had we had no microphones. It was a really fantastic production with just a string quartet. And so that did incredible things in terms of like actual vocal technique, because having to balance my own voice without a microphone against a cello was kind of amazing experience, actually. So, you know, you just kind of get better at it as you get older, you know.
Actually, that Passion show sounds great. I wish I'd seen it. Anyway.
Oh, it's so beautiful, yeah. It's a real downer. But
So, Anna Gasteyer, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you. So, since we're sitting here on public radio,
sure.
And since you were one of the hosts of Delicious
yes.
Dish,
yes.
Where did you get the idea for that? A public radio show about food. How did that ever cross your mind?
A public radio show about food that was on KCRW in Los Angeles. It was pretty much straight up. And I think there was might have been Splendid Table at that point, too. Is that syndicated still?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was nationally syndicated out of Minnesota, I think. So the part that made us laugh, which certainly wasn't true of either of these programs, is the idea of sort of passionless conversation about something as passionate as food, because I think food's pretty people get pretty passionate about it. So there was kind of a reserve that I, you know, the characters just were their own making, obviously. And then the thing that was the most fun, of course, you know, that my husband's always said this, the thing that's great about NPR, and I am an NPR listener, but it's also sort of you know, Achilles heel is because it's commercial free, you can wax poetic, as I probably have done this afternoon, without any pressure to wrap it up. and it allows for a lot of freedom of expression, but it also is, like I said, it's Achilles heel, which is kind of hilarious and really is what sets us apart from, you know, the kind of flash and pizzazz of commercial television and radio, which is very annoying in its own right. We did a sketch one time on SNL that went to dress rehearsal. So as you probably know, if you're a student at all of the show, you know, they overproduce the show. And dress rehearsal has millions of sketches that get cut, right, that never make it to the live show. And we did one day about the zoo crew, like a morning zoo.
Mm-hmm.
And we had every sound effect under the sun. It was so loud. It was so cacophonous. And the parody was about the cacophony, and it didn't get a single laugh, because it was like a play about a morning zoo. Everybody was so in the audience, they looked like, oh, yeah, well, that's a morning zoo. Like, that's what we're used to listening to in the morning. So,
well, it's hard to pull it out of its context, right? It's like, it's pretty funny on Parks and Recreation. There's a show that's hosted by someone called, it's Ira and the Douche or something. And,
yeah.
And it's funny in that context because the Amy Poehler character has to subject herself to this thing.
Right.
But it's, I think it's hard to pull something like that out of context and necessarily make it funny. Well, I'll ask you one more question about that, which was because I think I've been told that Alec Baldwin even occasionally listens to this show. So the famous, we have the clip ready to go. I think I'll make my station manager really happy and not play it, but we got the famous Shweddy Balls clip there, and it seems as though you're all trying to make each other laugh. My sense is that there's a little bit of a contest going on. Can somebody break somebody else? Am I wrong about that?
You are wrong. I mean, we worked very hard. I mean, at least for my goal, and I would say probably Alec too, that there's not that things, at least in my era, we all believed that things were funny when they were intense, when parody was intensely real and being taken very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of laughing at yourself, at least the laughing at yourself, is something I never wanted to get busted doing.
Mm-hmm.
It raises the stakes so much for the character to be believable.
Right.
And yes, we did start to sort of lose it on that one because it was so insane, that particular version of that sketch that night.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever been in Studio 8H to such a reaction. It was kind of like electric, but obviously the sketch has lived on and on, which is sort of amazing and was sort of a surprise. I mean, we had no idea, you know, that it was going to have the reaction, the impact that it did.
Right. Well, it's comedy legend now. And Anna Gasteyer, we want to remind people to come see you at the Kate in Old Saybrook on November 24th at 7:30. We're going to play one more song from the new CD, which will further incentivize you to go catch Anna.
Yeah, come on, tap your toes and have a good time. It's all about having fun for me. It's nothing, never serious.
Right. And by the way, I would encourage people to watch the video that Anna did of this song, One Mint Julep, a song.
Oh, yeah, Yorma Taconi from The Lonely Island directed it. It was it was such a great experience because he was exactly the person I was hoping would do it, because I knew it would look great, and I knew it would still have some comedy to it, and it wouldn't be confusing to anybody, like, wait, this is a comedy video, you know?
Right.
And I'm really proud of it. We had it was one of my favorite things that I've ever worked on.
All right, Anna Gasteyer, thanks for visiting with us, and let's go out with One Mint Julep.
Right on.
A mint julep, a mint julep, a mint julep. One mint julep, it was the cause of it all.
Hey!
Just a little slice of silver.
Occasionally it's hard for me to decide whether something's interesting just to me or will be interesting to the outside world. And in the case of our next guest, Rochelle Ripley, I'm very interested in the kind of the transition she's made in her life, because I first met her, I'm going to say 38 years ago.
I would say, yes.
Yeah, something along those lines. She was, I think, a relatively newly arrived Glastonbury housewife, mom, other stuff like that. I did not guess at the time that she had any connection to Native American culture. It did occur to me that she was Jewish and being plopped down in a pretty preppy Glastonbury culture, but that's about as far as that went. So I was really astonished to start reading about you and hearing about you and hearing about your new role as an activist on behalf of Native Americans, a group of people that includes you, and specifically the Lakota Sioux. So maybe I don't know where you want to start this story, but maybe it makes sense to start with the deathbed promise you made to your grandmother.
Well, it wasn't a deathbed promise. I was 5 years old, and I had had a very traumatic event in my life. There was a murder attempt on my life. Obviously, I survived, but it was very traumatic. And when I went to see my Lakota grandmother out west that summer, which we did on a regular basis, she did a healing ceremony on me, and she said, you know, when you grow up, I would like you to promise to go home and help our people. Because she said, I was born into two worlds, the Native and the non-Native, which included my Jewish side. And she said, you can bring those two different communities together. So I made that promise to her, not having any idea what it would mean. And I don't think she did either, really, to be honest with you. And all my life, I followed both paths. I have had a bat mitzvah. I went to Hebrew school. But I was also pursuing my Native path at the same time.
And so you are a quarter?
A quarter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so most recently you've been named to this list, the CNN list of the top 10 American heroes. There's a voting that goes on. We'll explain how people can vote for you if they want to and what that means. But specifically, what work has caused this? In other words, what attracted CNN's notice? What got you into this category?
Starting about 16 years ago, I went back for the first time to fulfill the promise to my grandmother, which meant going to the reservation with gifts for children for the holidays. Mm. We started with 600 children with a gift box of about $15 each, and it has grown now where we serve every child on the Cheyenne River Lakota Sioux Indian Reservation, which is about 2,000 kids, with a box that's worth probably about $150 to $200. So they get new clothes from us, they get a couple of toys, they get new books, they get some personal care products. And up until recently, we gave them school supplies. Now we have a partnership with UB Schools, and they provide all the school supplies for the children. So that's how it started. And from there, we began to expand because it became very clear that doing this giveaway was wonderful and needed, but it wasn't going to take care of the intransient problems that have been going on for 500 years in Indian country. So we expanded at that point. We started working on issues of housing, issues of education, health care, and then the basic needs for the broader community, food, home heating oil, all of those basic needs that we need for just surviving, especially in a climate like South Dakota where it's brutally cold in the winter. We started in 2008 with bringing out doctors, nurses, dentists, oral hygienists, providing free clinics. We also expanded into housing repairs. Habitat does more full rehabs. And on Cheyenne River, it is considered by the U.S. Census the poorest place in America. So families can't get mortgages and things that they may need to fully participate in Habitat's project. So we picked up the interim piece, which is doing repairs so people can stay in the homes that they have. And it's grown from there. We're now the official food pantry for the tribe. We collect here, we raise money here, and we purchase it, and then the retired military veterans on the reservation distribute all the food.
I think, well, I'll ask you, do you think there's a disconnect between how people, between what you're saying, the circumstances that you're describing, in many cases, dire circumstances in which your people find themselves, and what people think of with, I think a lot of people think, problem solved, they got casinos, whatever, it's
right.
2015, this is just not an issue.
Yeah, that is really the essential issue, particularly in the Great Plains area. The Native people there have never recovered from the decimation of the Native peoples across America. They're isolated geographically, politically, financially. There's just on our reservation, it's about a 90% unemployment rate. And we're also excluded for the most part from mainstream media. So when we're talking about issues of diversity, it is rare to hear a commentator say, well, an unemployment in Indian country is XYZ. So we're sort of put to the side and ignored, and that doesn't help to bring that spotlight on the issues and make them change. Yes, there are casinos here, certainly in the East Coast is sort of the penultimate casinos. But in South Dakota, it is legal to gamble anywhere. So it isn't going to take somebody 3 hours to drive to a remote Indian reservation to gamble when they can do it in their own hometown. So that's not even an option if we chose to pursue that, which at this point the Cheyenne River Tribe is not interested in pursuing that particular avenue. So we're working on home industries and things that can bring people to an economic standard that's a little better than where it is. Right now, the median income per person per year is $2,926. You
wow.
can't live on it.
No. What tipped you towards doing this 16 years ago?
When my daughter came to me for the first time to tell me I was about to become a grandmother for the first time, in that moment, that memory of my grandmother just flooded back. And at first, I think my daughter was taken a little aback because I didn't say anything right away because I was processing what I was thinking. Of course, I was thrilled. And so that was the seminal moment. The granddaughter was becoming the grandmother.
And so give us a sense, I mean, I know the answer to this question, but give us a sense of what you've been able to do in the last 16 years in terms of money raised, resources directed.
It comes to, as of December 31st, 2014, the total was just over $9 million. Mm. We're a fully volunteer organization. No one, including me, gets paid. So it really is 100% virtually of everything we get that goes out, other than, you know, minimal costs for postage and things like that.
Do you think your grandmother would be surprised by all this?
Oh, yeah. We have conversations all the time when I go out in the backyard and I light my sage and I say, what were you thinking? Because I'm sure she couldn't have envisioned this any more than I could have. But I'm sure she's also equally pleased.
Tell me a little bit more about what you know about her. I think her birth goes back close to the time of Wounded Knee, right?
Yeah, she was born just before, about 8 months before the massacre at Wounded Knee. We have a gap in there, which is not unusual for Native people because it was sometimes illegal, as it was here in Connecticut, to actually be Native American. I've never quite figured that one out. But people hid who they were because it wasn't safe, especially if they were off reservation. So we're not quite sure how her parents transited from South Dakota to northern Indiana, where she wound up. That piece is missing, and we'll probably never be able to retrieve that. But when I first would go out to her, she was in northern Indiana. She told us to be very proud of who we were, that we were Sioux from South Dakota, and we were Blackfoot Division. And that we're very fortunate to have that much information. But she, you know, she said, don't tell people who you are because it's not safe. There was a lot of Ku Klux Klan around her, and it was probably a wise thing. And I've often thought to her, well, I guess I didn't follow that instruction really well because I'm certainly public about who I am.
Well, when you first showed up there, hi, I'm Rochelle Ripley from Glastonbury, Connecticut. How'd that go over?
Yeah, not real well. obviously, Native people have an important reason to be cautious about trusting people. The history has not been kind in terms of doing that. People were sort of receptive. It took probably about 6 years till I could say I really was integrated in as somebody who was trusted and welcomed and really wanted there. And those were hard years because, you know, it's easy to pack up and say, who needs this? Mm-hmm. but I knew I had to keep my promise, and I knew that it was something that from all my community activism here in Connecticut that I'd done for years, as you're well aware of, I knew it would take time. And I think the one thing I did really, really well was that I never came in and said, hey, I have a good idea. Mm-hmm. It was always, I'm here, we have a group behind us, is there something we can help you with? And because the lead began with and stayed with the people who were on the reservation, I think it worked a lot better because of that.
What do you think, I mean, apart from the promise that you made as a very young girl to your grandmother, what do you, there's a lot of other people who probably have a kind of comparable ethnic makeup to yours and maybe access to some of the resources that you've been able to amass and divert towards your people. But, I mean, not everybody does this. I know you've had a fair amount of trauma, in personal trauma in your own life. Do you think that's sort of part of why you decided to do what you've decided to do?
I'd frame it a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. What I'd say is that the experiences I've had in my life, as very, very difficult as they are and have been, both myself personally through my childhood, where we had mental illness and we had lots of addictions, and it was a very traumatic childhood, the loss of my son to suicide 14 years ago, I think all of those informed how I interact with people more so than it informed my going on this particular path.
Yeah.
It makes me much more, I think, empathetic and realistic with families going through that on the reservation. And suicide is one of the biggest problems among our young people in the reservations now.
Oh, yeah. So this is very superficial compared to all of the things that we've been talking about so far. But over the past weekend, I got wound up on a sort of closed Facebook site where the people of Northwest Catholic High School are having one of these very typical debates that you're very familiar with, right, about either the keeping or getting rid of their mascot, the Indians. And in fact, officially, the school has gotten rid of the Indians. There's a lot of alumni tend to be a little bit on the older side or furious about this. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they say is, Indians don't mind it anyway. You know, I've talked to Indians. There's a Blackfoot where I work, and she says it's just fine. I apologize for bringing up something that superficial, except I think there is a through line,
right,
to everything that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's not superficial because the studies that have been done have shown that our children are very damaged by these images because they see themselves as animals or mascots or not real people that are acknowledged and not in the present because most of those images are back in the 1700s. And so they want to be acknowledged for being the young people that they are today and not to be characterized by an image. I worked very hard with Hall High on their changing of the mascot, and I heard all of the arguments of we're honoring you and we're saying as a Native group, and I'm talking the entire Native nations across America, the Congress of the American Indian, unanimously, you know, 500-plus tribes strong have asked for this to end. Mm. So if an individual may or may not be as well informed about it, that's not our issue. We've made a very clear statement about what we feel about that. Here in New England, there's a particular piece, and if we and I won't mention their name, but the Washington football team, the term that they use for their name is particularly offensive because it actually started here in New England with Governor Winthrop back in the Massachusetts Bay Colony when he declared that he would give bounties to people who would kill and bring in a dead Indian. They had to bring the body in. It was becoming very burdensome. So instead, he said they could bring in the bloody red skin from their head. And people don't know that. But in knowing that, now that they do, now they have responsibility, that when we name a team that, you're really saying, you know, it's okay to scalp and kill people. It was an okay thing in our history. So we really want people to, if they want to honor us, then become part of a giving that can help change conditions in Indian country. Honor your own tradition. I always say to people, you know, look at Notre Dame. Notre Dame does not use a religious symbol for their mascot. They use a leprechaun because it's more characteristic of sort of the play part of it. And we're just asking the same. When there's images and logos that include our eagle feathers are extremely sacred to us. If you're at a ceremony, a powwow, and an eagle feather falls on the ground, everything stops to re-honor that feather. So if you put your penultimate Native American caricature with two feathers on their head on your basketball court, you're running across it. You wouldn't do that with a cross or a Star of David, and you shouldn't do it with this either.
All right. So, Rochelle Ripley, as we're drawing to the end of this, although I could talk to you a lot more about all of this stuff, I think people, first of all, need to know how to vote for you. How do they vote for you in this CNN competition, I guess is the word.
Yeah. So if you go to CNNHeroes.com and scroll down just a little bit, you'll see a vote now. You click on that and then you scroll down and they show the 10 pictures of the 10 top 10. And hopefully you'll click on my picture and my name and then you just plug in your email and you vote. You can do it also on your handheld devices, and it's the same process.
And if you were to prevail here, you'd get $100,000. What would you do with it?
It's going to go towards a summer project next summer to build 9 units of housing. It's a pilot project where there'll be fairly small homes, not mini, but small. And we're looking to – housing is a crisis on our reservation. So we're looking to start moving one or two people into these 9 units. And if it's successful, it will be the model that we'll then be looking for larger funding for.
So win, lose, or draw. Meanwhile, people are still free to donate to your organization. And that's hawkwing.org?
Yes, correct. Hawkwing.org.
Hawkwing.org. So we'll try to put that up on our website too. But so, yeah, vote for Rochelle if that's if everything that she said has struck you as compelling. I can't imagine that it wouldn't. And go to hawkwing.org and make a donation today. Win, lose, or draw, there's a lot you can do with that money. Thanks for being with us.
Thank
Good to
you,
see
Colin.
You again.
Great
yeah.
to see you.
Okay, drop by in another 38 years.
Yeah, right. By then we'll be 110.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Amanda Gallagher and Zachary LaSala. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Benjamin Bratt. For show pages, articles, and a live stream from the Here and Now show staff's Sweat Lodge, visit our website WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, the history of the short story, film, and play known as Rear Window. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, if I could just say a little bit more about that show tomorrow. So Rear Window really began as a short story by Cornell Woolrich. I think it was called It Had to Be Murder. It wasn't called Rear Window anyway. I think it was called It Had to Be Murder. Cornell Woolrich was a very talented writer, started to write in the 20s and 30s. He was gay at a time when it was considerably more dangerous more dangerous, basically, to be gay than it is now. He attempted to marry. He suffered from alcoholism. He, at one point, had an amputated leg. So I think that might have actually been after he wrote the thing that became Rear Window. I'll know more about this tomorrow. Anyway, the story itself is a darker story than the Alfred Hitchcock, Jimmy Stewart thriller that you know. There's no Grace Kelly. There's no Thelma Ritter. And so what the Harvard Stage Company has done with Kevin Bacon in the lead role is to bring a little bit, some of that fragility and darkness back into the story. So we want to tell the whole story of Rear Window, the short story, the movie, the play that's playing at Harvard Stage Company right now, and kind of also why that particular particular story has held such fascination for us, which obviously has to do with voyeurism and all kinds of other basic human qualities that get dragged into that. So meanwhile, we're going to try something different here. We've got about 10 minutes left on the show. We don't usually do this. First of all, I'm going to make sure that you know the phone number, 860-275-7266. I'll give it out some other times. Also, the way to tweet at us, which is at WNPRColin. So, you know, I was in commercial radio for 16 years, and there's sort of a rule in commercial talk radio, which is you go on the air and you stake out a position. You stake out a really clear position, and you don't really waver from it. And that position then generates phone calls, you know, so people call up to either to disagree with you or to agree with you. And so what you don't do is what I'm about to do. which is to say, I'm really struggling with this. You know, I'm struggling with my own. I know how I feel about some of this, and I know what I object to. And then there are just other areas where I'm very, very confused. So this is maybe one reason I'm not still on commercial talk radio. There's not a huge market for confused people there. So ordinarily, you'd probably find me on the side of what people often denigrate as political correctness. For example, at the Durham Fair this year, there was a band called Confederate Railroad playing, and I was just, my position was, you know, I mean, for no other reason, imagine an African-American family, parents and their kids, you know, get some money together to go on some rides and have some crappy food at, you know, on the Midway. And then they see a band called Confederate Railroad. Why should they have to do that? Why should you? I mean, the Confederacy is really basically about slavery. Why should they have to see? Why should their town and their town fair or a town fair near them book an act called Confederate Railroad? So when I say things like that, I get accused of political correctness. You know, watching the aforementioned debate over Northwest Catholic's mascot, I certainly lean towards the side of that Rochelle Ripley just articulated, that, you know, these things, they've had their day. They need to go. They really are fundamentally offensive to the people that they're about. And we use them without really thinking that much about them or what they mean. However, on college campuses today, there's something else that's going on that's in some ways a part of that whole, but also different from it. And we're seeing it. We saw it a few weeks ago at Wesleyan, where the Argus, the student newspaper, ran an op-ed piece that was somewhat critical of the Black Lives Matter movement and the reaction of the student government. First of all, there was a petition asking that the newspaper be defunded. Ultimately, the student government, in a way that seemed to kind of overlap with that petition drive, radically downgraded the newspaper's funding and sort of made it a much more competitive process, kind of bringing the newspaper to heel in a certain way. I find that a little bit disturbing. And then what's going on the campus of Yale right now is very complicated and very nuanced. And as is the case with Missouri, where today their president, Timothy Wolf, stepped down under pressure after the football team refused to play. If he didn't step down, if he didn't have to be forced to, if he wasn't forced to leave office. These are really granular, complicated situations, and there's sort of a Rashomon-like quality. People tell the stories a little bit differently. They're not identical situations, Yale and Missouri, although there are some similarities. The similarities would include kind of physical face-to-face confrontations on campus between administrators and very angry students, for the most part students representing the minority population or the part of the student population concerned and sympathetic about ways in which minorities would feel less safe on campus. There's also the similarity that in each case the students have made a big reach and a big ask. I mean, in each case the students have either demanded or suggested that certain people be forced to resign. And in the case of Missouri, that actually happened. So what's going on at Yale is hard to sort of piece together. There clearly has been a longer-running problem of students at Yale feeling as though that it's a tougher place for African-American students in particular than it should be, that there are slights, that there are insults, that the administration isn't quick enough about responding to some of their concerns. So there's that kind of underlay or overlay. And then as Halloween approached, One dean of Yale put out an email suggesting that people kind of watch it with their costumes and think about costumes that they wear that might, in fact, excite other people's sensibilities and might be harmful or disturbing to other people. And I think it even suggested some more innocuous Halloween costumes. And so there was that. Then there were there was the master of Silliman College and his wife, the associate master there, who kind of came back and said, well, you know, maybe part of an academic environment involves the ability of people, particularly, you know, around, you know, with Halloween being a time. I mean, the, sort of the code, the DNA code of Halloween is that that weird stuff comes out. So maybe trying to make Halloween this kind of sanitized, purified place where nothing, no disturbing content ever surfaces, you know, maybe that's going a little bit too far. And maybe we should accept the fact that sometimes we'll see things that disturb us and then we'll talk about them. I think I'm summarizing their views. So anyway, there have been two confrontations, one of them between Jonathan Holloway, who's the overall dean of Yale College. He's the first black dean, first black academic to hold that position, and African-American students confronted him about this. And then in something that's been shared a lot on YouTube, students kind of surrounded the master of Silliman College and demanded that he apologize for in any way suggesting that for his and his own wife's, Erica's, suggestion that that maybe, you know, there's room in the world for people to have Halloween costumes that don't completely please other people. So anyway, I'll say one more thing, which is that in 1975, Yale drafted probably the strongest statement by any American university at that time, affirming the notion that a college is a place where people should encounter disconcerting ideas, where the people should think the unthinkable and say the unsayable, that there should be that kind of freedom. And that was in response to some truly disturbing stuff, stuff that went way beyond Halloween costumes. George Wallace had been invited to speak on the campus and then disinvited. William Shockley, George Wallace is the governor of Alabama, very much associated with school segregation, an ardent opponent of proponent of segregation and an opponent of the civil rights of African Americans. William Shockley, a Nobel Prize winner in physics for development, I think, of the semiconductor, had then emerged as this kind of crackpot itinerant speaker who was basically arguing that African Americans have naturally lower IQs. He'd also been invited to the campus. So the question is, do we let people like this on campus? And this report, the Woodward Report, said, yes, we do. Even if these things make us wretch, we do, because that's how we learn that, you know, it's you don't want to sanitize your environment so much that no conversation ever really takes place. All right, I've used up almost all the time summarizing the problem. But anyway, I'm struggling with this a lot. Well, let me just grab a call here from Justin in Wallingford. It's probably all we'll have time for, unfortunately. But hi, Justin, you're on the air.
Hi, Colin. Thank you. You know, I think the proper way to look at it is that you have free speech, which, of course, if you use it, opens you up to criticism, but people shouldn't be using it like a cudgel to, you know, beat people over the head until they, you know, can't exercise it back.
Yeah, I think that's right, that free speech means that I can say, I hate what you just said. You know, it makes me furious. It hurts me. It makes me afraid that you're on my campus saying this. But it doesn't.
But then you can move on.
Right. It doesn't give me the right to say, and therefore I feel like whoever invited you needs to be fired right away. And sort of that's the point that we're at. Yeah, I think you and I are kind of on the same page here, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the only reasonable, rational way to handle it.
Right. But and so the biggest struggle here is that free speech means something different. An unfettered educational inquiry means something very different to different people. You know, in the course of supporting free speech, you're also opening yourself up to criticism by other people through their exercise of free speech. I do think we get a lot further when we talk with each other than when we yell at each other. What I'm seeing in Missouri and at Yale right now is a lot of yelling at and not so much talking with. Maybe the talking with would be a little better. All right. Thanks to everybody who helped out today. I hope this was okay, that we did something different here in the sea. We loved Anna. We loved Rochelle. We'll be back tomorrow with Rear Window. Come on.